creating a small region in each visual field where we are effectively blind. Many of us learned as children to perceive the subjective consequences of this less-than-ideal anatomy by drawing a small circle on a piece of paper, closing one eye, and then moving the paper into a position where the circle became invisible. No doubt most people in human history have been totally unaware of the optic blind spot. Even those of us who know about it go for decades without noticing it, and yet it is always there, right on the surface of experience. The absence of the self is also there to be noticed. As with the optic blind spot, the evidence is not far away or deep within. Rather, it is almost too close to be observed. For most people, experiencing the intrinsic selflessness of consciousness requires considerable training. It is, however, possible to notice that consciousness, that in you which is aware of your experience in this moment, does not feel like a self. It does not feel like I. What you are calling I is itself a feeling that arises among the contents of consciousness. Consciousness is prior to it, a mere witness of it, and therefore free of it in principle. The challenge of studying the self. Many scientists use the term self to refer to the totality of our inner lives. I have attended whole conferences on the self and read books ostensibly devoted to this topic, without seeing the feeling we call I even mentioned. The self that I am discussing throughout this book, the illusory, albeit reliable source of so much suffering and confusion, is the feeling that there is an inner subject behind our eyes, thinking our thoughts and experiencing our experience. We must distinguish between the self and the myriad mental states, self-recognition, volition, memory, bodily awareness, with which it can be associated. Consider the semi-fictional condition of a person suffering from global retrograde amnesia, sometimes called soap opera amnesia, wherein a person has entirely forgotten his past. If asked how he came to be this way, he might say, "I don't remember anything." This is overstating the case, for he must remember a thing or two, the English language, for instance, to even make such a statement. But there's no reason to think that he is misusing the personal pronoun I. His I seems to have survived the loss of his declarative memories as fully as his body has. If we ask him, "Where's your body?" he might say, "It's here, this is it." If we question him further, asking, "And where are you? Where's yourself?" he would probably say something like, "What do you mean? I'm here too, I just don't know who I am." Strange as this conversation would be, there seems little doubt that our protagonist would feel as much like a self as we do. Only his memories are missing. He, as the subject of his experience, remains to worry over their absence. Of course, as a person, this man is no longer himself. He doesn't remember the names or the faces of his closest friends. He may not know which foods he likes. His private fears and professional goals have disappeared without a trace. We may say that he is scarcely a person at all, but he is a self all the same, and one that is suffering a bewildering dissociation from both past and future. Or consider the condition of a person who is having an out-of-body experience, abbreviated as OBE. The sense of leaving one's body is a staple of mystical literature and has been reported across many cultures. It is often associated with epilepsy, migraine, sleep paralysis, and, as we will see in Chapter 5, the, quote, near-death experience. It may occur in as much as 10% of the population. During an OBE, the subject feels that she has physically left her body, and this often includes a sense that she can see her own body in full, as though from a point outside her head. A brain area called the temporal parietal junction, a region known to be involved in sensory integration and body representation, seems to be responsible for this effect. Whether or not a person's consciousness can really be displaced is irrelevant. The point is that it can seem to be, and this fact draws yet another boundary between the self and the rest of our personhood. It is possible to experience oneself as apparently outside a body. The self, as the implied hub of cognition, perception, emotion, and behavior, can remain stable across even wholesale changes in the contents of consciousness, unless the feeling of self disappears. This is not surprising, because the self is the very thing to which these contents seem to refer. Not the body or mind per se, but the point of view from which both body and mind seem to be mine in every present moment. Thus we can see that most scientific research on the self is too broad. If the sense of self is a sense of being the subject of experience, it should not be conflated with a wider range of experiences. I refers to the feeling that our faculties have been appropriated, that a center of will and cognition interior to the body, somewhere behind the face, is doing the seeing, hearing, and thinking. And yet in seeking to understand the self, many scientists study things such as spatial cognition, voluntary action, feelings of body ownership, and episodic memory. While these phenomena greatly influence our experience in each moment, they are not integral to the feeling that we call I. Consider the sense of body ownership. It must be produced at least in part by the integration of different streams of sensory information. We feel the position of our limbs in space. We see them at appropriate locations in our visual field. And our experience of touching objects generally coincides with the sight of them coming into contact with our skin. An analogous synchrony occurs whenever we execute a voluntary movement. No doubt our sense of body ownership is essential for our survival and for relating to others. Any loss or distortion of this sense can be profoundly disorienting. But disorienting to whom? When I am lying on the operating table, feeling the first effects of intravenous sedation, and find that I can no longer sense the position of my limbs in space, or even the existence of my body, who is it that has been deprived of these inputs? It is I, the almost ever-present subject of my experience. It should be obvious that no faculty of which I might be deprived, while I remain the subject, experiencing the results of such deprivation, can be integral to the self, though it may be integral to my personhood in a wider sense. Several findings in the neuroscientific literature drive a wedge between body ownership and the feeling of being a self. For instance, a person can lose the sense of owning a limb, a condition known as somatoparaphrenia. Conversely, a person's body image can encompass the limbs of others, or even inanimate objects. Consider the famous rubber hand illusion. Each of 10 subjects was seated with their left arm resting upon a small table. A standing screen was positioned beside the arm to hide it from the subject's view, and a life-sized rubber model of a left hand and arm was placed on the table, directly in front of the subject. The subject sat with eyes fixed on the artificial hand, while we used two small paintbrushes to stroke the rubber hand and the subject's hidden hand, synchronizing the timing of the brushing as closely as possible. Subjects experienced an illusion in which they seemed to feel the touch, not of the hidden brush, but that of the viewed brush, as if the rubber hand had sensed the touch. Amazingly, through the use of head-mounted video displays, this illusion can be extended to the entire body, yielding an experience of, quote, body swapping. It has long been known that vision trumps proprioception, the awareness of the position of one's body, when it comes to locating parts of one's body in space. But the body swapping illusion suggests that visual perception may fully determine the coordinates of the self. The point, however, is that this effect, dissociation from one's own body and a false sense of inhabiting the parts or whole body of another person, seems to leave the self very much intact. Experiments on proprioception tell us nothing about the feeling that we call I. And the same can be said for almost every other aspect of personhood with which philosophers, psychologists, and neuroscientists regularly bundle the self. The feeling of agency, the sense that one is the author of one's voluntary actions, may be as integral to our experience of the world as body ownership, but it too fails to capture what we mean by self. A person could, for instance, distinguish his bodily movements from those of another person without feeling a sense of self at all, for to do so merely requires that he distinguish one body as an object from another. Likewise, he could fail to make such a distinction in that he might misattribute his actions to another person or ascribe the actions of another person to himself while feeling the embrace of selfhood all the while. Ascriptions of agency do not define the contours of the self in the way that many people seem to believe. While schizophrenics, suffering from thought insertion, delusions of control, and auditory hallucinations, may be assailed by unusual mental phenomena, nothing suggests that their sense of being a self has been altered or lost. A person can fail to distinguish between self-generated and world-generated content, and thereby mistake her own internal imagery for sense data. There is a difference, to be sure, between finding a rat in one's bed and hallucinating or merely dreaming about such an encounter. But the feeling of being a self remains constant. Self-recognition. Imagine that you awake from a heavy sleep to find yourself imprisoned in an unfamiliar, windowless room. Where are you? You haven't the faintest idea. A mirror has been provided for your edification, however, and you gaze into it. What do you see? A red dot has been painted on your forehead, but for some reason you fail to notice it. In fact, you soon lose interest in your reflection altogether and begin searching your room for food. You are, after all, a gorilla and quite unconcerned about your appearance. In reviewing the literature on the self, one finds that much has been made of the fact that some creatures will attend to their reflections in a mirror with all the vanity of an 18th-century lady-in-waiting, while others respond as though they would to a fellow member of their species. The, quote, mirror test has been a staple of primate and child development research for many decades now, and it has made this simplest of all laboratory devices seem like a virtual dowsing rod for the self, because only those creatures who comport themselves with the requisite narcissism in front of the glass are believed to possess, quote, self-knowledge, or even, and here we are treated to an especially depressing misuse of the term, consciousness. While mirror self-recognition and use of the personal pronoun seem to emerge more or less at the same time in human development, 15 to 24 months, there are many reasons to believe that self-recognition and selfhood are distinct states of mind, and therefore that they differ at the level of the brain as well. Self-recognition depends on context. There are neurological patients who cannot recognize themselves in a mirror, a condition called the mirror sign delusion, but can pick themselves out in photographs, and these subjects show no evidence of having lost anything like a self or knowledge thereof. So what is the relationship between self-recognition and the feeling we call I? The fact that the word self is generally used while making reference to these phenomena does not suggest that any deep relationship exists between them. It seems quite possible, for instance, that a person who cannot recognize his own face under any circumstances could have a fully intact sense of self, just as your sense of self would remain unaltered by the sight of a complete stranger. There is simply nothing about the experience of not recognizing a face, even if it happens to be one's own, that suggests a divestiture of self or anything like it. Theory of mind. One of the most important things we do with our minds is attribute mental states to other people, a faculty that has been variously described as theory of mind, mentalizing, mindsight, mind reading, and the intentional stance. The ability to recognize and interpret the mental activity of others is essential for normal cognition and social development, and deficits in this area contribute to a variety of mental disorders, including autism. But what is the relationship between an awareness of others and an awareness of oneself? Many scientists and philosophers have suggested that the two must be deeply connected. If so, it seems natural that research on theory of mind, abbreviated as TOM, would shed some light on the structure of the self. Unfortunately, however, the model of TOM that researchers generally work with cannot do this. Consider the following text, intended to evoke theory of mind processing in experimental subjects. A burglar who has just robbed a shop is making his getaway. As he is running home, a policeman on his beat sees him drop his glove. He doesn't know the man is a burglar. He just wants to tell him he dropped his glove. But when the policeman shouts out to the burglar, "Hey, you, stop!" the burglar turns around, sees the policeman, and gives himself up. He puts his hands up and admits that he did the break-in at the local shop. Question: why did the burglar do that? The answer is obvious, unless one happens to be a young child or a person suffering from autism. If one can't take the point of view of the burglar in this story, it is impossible to know why he behaved as he did. Experimental stimuli of this kind are central to research on theory of mind, but they have very little to do with our most basic attribution of mindedness to others. Although we use our powers of inference to attribute complex mental states to other people, and the phrase theory of mind captures this, it seems that we make a much more basic attribution first, and perhaps independently. We recognize that other people are or can be aware of us. Explaining the burglar's behavior requires a higher level of cognition than is necessary to merely grasp that one is in the presence of a sentient other. And the feeling that another person can see or hear me is quite distinct from my having any understanding of his beliefs or desires. This more primitive judgment would seem to be theory of mind at its most fundamental. It might also have a deep connection to our sense of self. The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre believed that our encounters with other people constitute the primal circumstance of self-formation. On his account, each of us is perpetually in the position of a voyeur who, while gazing upon the object of his lust, suddenly hears the sound of someone stepping up directly behind him. Again and again, we are thrust out of the safety and seclusion of pure subjectivity by the knowledge that we've become objects in the world for others. I believe that Sartre was onto something. The primitive impression that another creature is aware of us seems to be the point at which theory of mind is relevant to the sense of self. If you doubt this, I recommend the following exercise. Go to a public place, select a person at random, and stare at his face until he returns your gaze. To make this more than a pointless provocation, observe the change that occurs in you the moment eye contact is established. What is this feeling that obliges you to immediately look away or to begin speaking? The self-ramifying quality of this form of theory of mind seems indisputable, for without the attribution of awareness to others, you have no sense of being looked at in the first place. There's a difference to be felt here. Being looked at just feels different from not being looked at, and the difference can be described, or so I maintain, as a magnification of the feeling that we call I. It seems undeniable that self-consciousness and this more fundamental theory of mind are closely related. The neurologist V.S. Ramachandran seemed to have been thinking along these lines when he wrote, "It may not be coincidental that you use phrases like self-conscious when you really mean that you are conscious of others being conscious of you." To better appreciate the distinction between fundamental theory of mind and the theory of mind that is current in the scientific literature, consider what happens when we watch a film. The experience of sitting in a darkened theater and seeing people interact with one another on the screen is a social encounter of sorts, but it is one in which we as participants have been perfectly effaced. This very likely explains why most of us find movies and television so compelling. The moment we turn our eyes to the screen, we are in a social situation that our hominid genes could never have foreseen. We can view the actions of others, along with the minutiae of their facial expressions, even to the point of making eye contact with them, without the slightest risk of being observed ourselves. Movies and televisions magically transform the primordial context of face-to-face encounters, in which human beings have always been subjected to harrowing social lessons, allowing us, for the first time, to devote ourselves wholly to the act of observing other people. This is voyeurism of a transcendental kind. Whatever else might be said about the experience of watching a film, it fully dissociates fundamental theory of mind from standard theory of mind. For there is no doubt that we attribute mental states to the actors on the screen. We make all the judgments that the standard theory of mind requires, but this does little to establish our sense of self. Indeed, it is difficult to find a situation in which we feel less self-conscious than when sitting in a darkened theater watching a film, and yet we are contemplating the beliefs, intentions, and desires of other people the entire time. Ramachandran and others have noted that the discovery of mirror neurons offers some support for the idea that the senses of self and other may emerge from the same circuitry in the brain. Some people believe that mirror neurons are also central to our ability to empathize with others, and may even account for the emergence of gestural communication and spoken language. What we do know is that certain neurons increase their firing rate when we perform object-oriented actions with our hands, grasping, manipulating, and communicative or ingestive actions with our mouths. These neurons also fire, albeit less rapidly, whenever we witness the same actions performed by other people. Research on monkeys suggests that these neurons encode the intentions behind an observed action, such as picking up an apple for the purpose of eating it versus merely moving it, rather than the physical movements themselves. In these experiments, a monkey's brain seems to represent the purposeful behavior of others as if it were engaging in this behavior itself. Similar results have been obtained in neuroimaging experiments done on humans. Some scientists believe that mirror neurons provide a physiological basis for the development of imitation and social bonding early in life, and for the understanding of other minds thereafter. And it is certainly suggestive that children with autism appear to have diminished mirror neuron activity in proportion to the severity of their symptoms. As is now widely known, people suffering from autism tend to lack insight into the mental lives of others. Conversely, a longitudinal study of compassion meditation, which produced a significant increase in subjects' empathy over the course of 8 weeks, found increased activity in one of the regions believed to contain mirror neurons. It may be that an awareness of other minds is a necessary condition for an awareness of one's own. Of course, this does not suggest that the feeling we call I will disappear when we are alone. If our knowledge of self and other is truly indivisible, our awareness of others may be internalized early in life. In psychological terms, this certainly seems a plausible way of describing the structure of our subjectivity. All parents have seen their children put their growing powers of speech to use by maintaining running monologues with themselves. These monologues continue throughout life as though they were, in fact, dialogues. The resulting conversation seems both strange and unnecessary. Why should we live in relationship to ourselves rather than merely as ourselves? Why should I and me be keeping each other company? Imagine that you have lost your sunglasses. You search the house up and down, and finally you spot them lying on a table where you had left them the day before. You promptly think, "There they are," as you make your way across the room to retrieve them. But to whom are you thinking this thought? You may have even uttered the phrase out loud, "There they are." But who needed to be informed in this way? You have already seen them. Is there someone else in your search party? Imagine that you are in a public place and happen to see a stranger locate his own lost sunglasses. He exclaims, as you might, "There they are," and snatches them from the tabletop. A twinge of embarrassment often passes through all parties in such moments. But when the utterance is confined to a short phrase and occasioned by such an innocuous event, the speaker has done nothing out of the ordinary, and bystanders are not yet gripped by fear. Imagine, however, if this person continued to address himself out loud. "Where did you think they were, you idiot? You've been wandering around this building for 10 minutes. Now I'm going to be late for my lunch with Julia, and she's always on time." The man need not speak another word to secure our eternal mistrust of his faculties. And yet the condition of this person is no different from our own. These are precisely the thoughts we might think in the privacy of our minds. We have seen that the sense of self is logically and empirically distinct from many other features of the mind with which it is often conflated. In order to understand it at the level of the brain, therefore, we need to study people who no longer experience it. As we will see, certain practices of meditation are very well suited to research of this kind. Penetrating the illusion. As a matter of neurology, the sense of having a persistent and unified self must be an illusion, because it is built upon processes that, by their very nature as processes, are transitory and multifarious. There is no region of the brain that can be the seat of a soul. Everything that makes us human, our emotional lives, capacity for language, the impulses that give rise to complex behavior, and our ability to restrain other impulses that we consider uncivilized, is spread across the entirety of the cortex and many subcortical brain regions as well. The whole brain is involved in making us what we are, so we need not await any data from the lab to say that the self cannot be what it seems. The sense that we are unified subjects is a fiction, produced by a multitude of separate processes and structures of which we are not aware and over which we exert no conscious control. What is more, many of these processes can be independently disturbed, producing deficits that would seem impossible if they were not so easily verified. Some people, for instance, are able to see perfectly, but are unable to detect motion. Others are able to see objects and their motion, but are unable to locate them in space. How the mind depends upon the brain, and the manner in which its powers can be disrupted, defies common sense. Here, as elsewhere in science, how things seem is often a poor guide to how they are. The claim that we can experience consciousness without a conventional sense of self, that there is no rider on the horse, seems to be on firm ground neurologically. Whatever causes the brain to produce the false notion that there is a thinker living somewhere inside the head, it makes sense that it could stop doing this. And once it does, our inner lives become more faithful to the facts. How can we know that the conventional sense of self is an illusion? When we look closely, it vanishes. This is compelling in the same way that the disappearance of any illusion is. You thought something was there, but upon closer inspection, you see that it isn't. What doesn't survive scrutiny cannot be real. The classic example from the Indian tradition is of a coiled rope mistaken for a snake. Imagine that you spot a snake in the corner of a room and feel an immediate cascade of fear. You then notice that it isn't moving. You look more closely and see that it doesn't appear to have a head. And suddenly you spot coiled strands of fiber that you mistook for a pattern of scales. You move closer and can see that it is a rope. A skeptic might ask, how do you know that the rope is real and the snake an illusion? This question may seem reasonable, but only to a person who hasn't had the experience of looking closely at the snake only to have it disappear. Given that the snake always collapses into being a rope and not the other way around, there's simply no empirical basis upon which to form such a doubt. Perhaps you can see the same effect with certain visual illusions. It certainly looks like there's a white square superimposed upon four black circles, but when you look closely at the image, it becomes clear that there are only four partial circles. The square has been imposed by our visual system, whose edge detectors have been fooled. Can we know that the black shapes are more real than the white square? Yes, because the square doesn't survive our efforts to locate it. Its edges literally disappear. A little investigation, we see that its form has been merely implied. In fact, it is possible to look closely enough at certain visual illusions to banish the effect altogether. But what could we say to a skeptic who insisted that the visual illusion is just as real as the lines that are actually on the page? This is not necessarily a matter of debating third-person facts. It's a matter of looking more closely at experience itself. In the next chapter, we will see that the illusion of the self can be investigated and dispelled in just this way. Chapter 4. Meditation. Psychologists and neuroscientists now acknowledge that the human mind tends to wander, engaging in what has been called stimulus-independent thought. The primary method of studying mental phenomena of this kind outside the lab is a technique called experience sampling. Using a mobile phone or some other device, subjects are simply prompted to describe what they are doing and how they feel at random intervals throughout the day. One study found that when asked whether their mind was wandering, that is, whether they were thinking about something unrelated to their current experience, subjects reported being lost in thought 46.9% of the time. Anyone who is trained in meditation will know that the true figure is surely higher, especially if we count all the thinking that, while perhaps superficially related to the task at hand, nevertheless constitutes an unnecessary distraction from it. As unreliable as such self-reports must be, this study found that people are consistently less happy when their minds are wandering, even when the contents of their thoughts are pleasant. The authors concluded that, quote, "a human mind is a wandering mind, and a wandering mind is an unhappy mind," end quote. Anyone who has spent time on silent retreat will agree. The wandering mind has been correlated with activities in the brain's midline regions, especially the medial prefrontal cortex and the medial parietal cortex. These areas are often called the default mode or resting state network, because they are most active when we are just biding our time, waiting for something to happen. Activity in the default mode network decreases when subjects concentrate on tasks of the sort employed in most neuroimaging experiments. The default mode network has also been linked with our capacity for self-representation. For instance, if a person believes that she is tall, the term tall should yield greater signal in these midline regions than the term short. Similarly, the default mode network is more engaged when we make such judgments of relevance about ourselves as opposed to making them about other people. It also tends to be more active when we evaluate a scene from a first-person rather than a third-person point of view. Generally speaking, to pay attention outwardly reduces activity in the brain's midline, while thinking about oneself increases it. These results appear mutually reinforcing and might explain the common experience we have of, quote, losing ourselves in our work. Mindfulness and loving-kindness meditation also decrease activity in the default mode network. And the effect is most pronounced among experienced meditators, both while meditating and at rest. While it is too early to draw strong conclusions from these findings, they hint at a physical connection between the experience of being lost in thought and the sense of self, as well as a mechanism by which meditation might reduce both. Long-term meditation practice is also associated with a variety of structural changes in the brain. Meditators tend to have larger corpora callosa and hippocampi in both hemispheres. The practice is also linked to increased gray matter thickness and cortical folding. Some of these differences are especially prominent in older practitioners, which suggests that meditation could protect against age-related thinning of the cortex. The cognitive, emotional, and behavioral significance of these anatomical findings have not yet been worked out, but it is not hard to see how they might explain the kinds of experiences and psychological changes that meditators report. Expert meditators, with greater than 10,000 hours of practice, respond differently to pain than novices do. They judge the intensity of an unpleasant stimulus to be the same, but they find it to be less unpleasant. They also show reduced activity in regions associated with anxiety while anticipating the onset of pain, as well as faster habituation to the stimulus once it arrives. Other research has found that mindfulness reduces both the unpleasantness and intensity of noxious stimuli. It has long been known that stress, especially early in life, alters brain structure. For instance, studies both in animals and in humans have shown that early stress increases the size of the amygdala. One study found that an 8-week program of mindfulness meditation reduced the volume of the right basolateral amygdala, and these changes were correlated with a subjective decrease in stress. Another found that a full day of mindfulness practice among trained meditators reduced the expression of several genes that produce inflammation throughout the body, and this correlated with an improved response to social stress. Diabolically, subjects were asked to give a brief speech and then perform mental calculations while being videotaped in front of an audience. A mere 5 minutes of practice a day for 5 weeks increased left-sided baseline activity in the frontal cortex, a pattern that, as we saw in the discussion of the split brain, has been associated with positive emotions. A review of the psychological literature suggests that mindfulness in particular fosters many components of physical and mental health. It improves immune function, blood pressure, and cortisol levels. It reduces anxiety, depression, neuroticism, and emotional reactivity. It also leads to greater behavioral regulation and has shown promise in the treatment of addiction and eating disorders. Unsurprisingly, the practice is associated with increased subjective well-being. Training in compassion meditation increases empathy, as measured by the ability to accurately judge the emotions of others, as well as positive affect in the presence of suffering. The practice of mindfulness has been shown to have similar pro-social effects. Scientific research on the various types of meditation is just beginning, but there are now hundreds of studies suggesting that these practices are good for us. Again, from a first-person point of view, none of this is surprising. After all, there's an enormous difference between being hostage to one's thoughts and being freely and non-judgmentally aware of life in the present. To make this shift is to interrupt the processes of rumination and reactivity that often keep us so desperately at odds with ourselves and with other people. No doubt many distinct mechanisms are involved. The regulation of attention and behavior, increased body awareness, inhibition of negative emotions, conceptual reframing of experiences, changes in the view of self, and so forth. And each of these processes will have its own neurophysiological causes. In the broadest sense, however, meditation is simply the ability to stop suffering in many of the usual ways, if only for a few moments at a time. How could that not be a skill worth cultivating? Gradual versus sudden realization. We wouldn't attempt to meditate or engage in any other contemplative practice if we didn't feel that something about our experience needed to be improved. But here lies one of the central paradoxes of spiritual life, because this very feeling of dissatisfaction causes us to overlook the intrinsic freedom of consciousness in the present. As we have seen, there are good reasons to believe that adopting a practice like meditation can lead to positive changes in one's life. But the deepest goal of spirituality is freedom from the illusion of the self, and to seek such freedom, as though it were a future state to be attained through effort, is to reinforce the chains of one's apparent bondage in each moment. Traditionally, there have been two solutions to this paradox. One is to simply ignore it and to adopt various techniques of meditation in the hope that a breakthrough will occur. Some people appear to succeed at this, but many fail. It is true that good things often happen in the meantime. We can become happier and more concentrated, but we can also despair of the whole project. The words of the sages may begin to sound like empty promises, and we are left hoping for transcendent experiences that never arrive or prove merely temporary. The ultimate wisdom of enlightenment, whatever it is, cannot be a matter of having fleeting experiences. The goal of meditation is to uncover a form of well-being that is inherent to the nature of our minds. It must therefore be available in the context of ordinary sights, sounds, sensations, and even thoughts. Peak experiences are fine, but real freedom must be coincident with normal waking life. The other traditional response to the paradox of spiritual seeking is to fully acknowledge it and concede that all efforts are doomed, because the urge to attain self-transcendence or any other mystical experience is a symptom of the very disease we want to cure. There is nothing to do but give up the search. These paths may appear antithetical, and they are often presented as such. The path of gradual ascent is typical of Theravada Buddhism and most other approaches to meditation in the Indian tradition. And gradualism is the natural starting point for any search, spiritual or otherwise. Such goal-oriented modes of practice have the virtue of being easily taught, because a person can begin them without having had any fundamental insight into the nature of consciousness or the illusoriness of the self. He need only adopt new patterns of attention, thought, and behavior, and the path will unfold before him. By contrast, the path of sudden realization can appear impossibly steep. It is often described as non-dualistic, because it refuses to validate the point of view from which one would meditate or practice any other spiritual discipline. Consciousness is already free of anything that remotely resembles a self, and there is nothing you can do, as an illusory ego, to realize this. Such a perspective can be found in the Indian tradition of Advaita Vedanta, and in a few schools of Buddhism. Those who begin to practice in the spirit of gradualism often assume that the goal of self-transcendence is far away, and they may spend years overlooking the very freedom that they yearn to realize. The liability of this approach became clear to me when I studied under the Burmese meditation master Sayadaw Upandita. I sat through several retreats with Upandita, each a month or two in length. These retreats were based on the monastic discipline of Theravada Buddhism. We did not eat after noon, and we were encouraged to sleep no more than 4 hours each night. Outwardly, the goal was to engage in 18 hours of formal meditation each day. Inwardly, it was to follow the stages of insight as laid down in Buddhaghosa's 5th century treatise, the Visuddhimagga, and elaborated in the writings of Upandita's own legendary teacher, Mahasi Sayadaw. The logic of this practice is explicitly goal-oriented. According to this view, one practices mindfulness not because the intrinsic freedom of consciousness can be fully realized in the present, but because being mindful is a means of attaining an experience often described as cessation, which is thought to decisively uproot the illusion of the self, along with other mental afflictions, depending on one's stage of practice. Cessation is believed to be a direct insight into an unconditioned reality. The Pali word is nibbana, Sanskrit nirvana, that lies behind all manifest phenomena. This conception of the path to enlightenment is open to several criticisms. The first is that it is misleading with respect to what can be realized in the present moment in a state of ordinary awareness. Thus, it encourages confusion at the outset regarding the nature of the problem one is trying to solve. It is true, however, that striving toward the distant goal of enlightenment, as well as the nearer goal of cessation, can lead one to practice with an intensity that might be otherwise difficult to achieve. I never made more effort than I did when practicing under Upandita. But most of this effort arose from the very illusion of bondage to the self that I was seeking to overcome. The model of this practice is that one must climb the mountain so that freedom can be found at the top. But the self is already an illusion, and that truth can be glimpsed directly, at the mountain's base or anywhere else along the path. One can then return to this insight again and again as one's sole method of meditation, thereby arriving at the goal in each moment of actual practice. This isn't merely a matter of choosing to think differently about the significance of mindfulness. It's a difference in what one is able to be mindful of. Dualistic mindfulness, paying attention to the breath, for instance, generally proceeds on the basis of an illusion. One feels that one is a subject, a locus of consciousness inside the head, that can strategically pay attention to the breath or some other object of awareness because of all the good it will do. This is gradualism in action. And yet from a non-dualistic point of view, one could just as well be mindful of selflessness directly. To do this, however, one must recognize that this is how consciousness is, and such an insight can be difficult to achieve. However, it does not require the meditative attainment of cessation. Another problem with the goal of cessation is that most traditions of Buddhism do not share it, and yet they produce long lineages of contemplative masters, many of whom have spent decades doing nothing but meditating on the nature of consciousness. If freedom is possible, there must be some mode of ordinary consciousness in which it can be expressed. Why not realize this frame of mind directly? Nevertheless, I spent several years deeply preoccupied with reaching the goal of cessation, and at least 1 year of that time was spent on silent retreat. Although I had many interesting experiences, none seemed to fit the specific requirements of this path. There were periods during which all thought subsided, and any sense of having a body disappeared. What remained was a blissful expanse of conscious peace that had no reference point in any of the usual sensory channels. Many scientists and philosophers believe that consciousness is always tied to one of the five senses, and that the idea of pure consciousness, apart from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, is a category error and a spiritual fantasy. I am confident that they are mistaken. But cessation never arrived. Given my gradualist views at that point, This became very frustrating. Most of my time on retreat was extremely pleasant, but it seemed to me that I had been merely given the tools with which to contemplate the evidence of my non-enlightenment. My practice had become a vigil, a method of waiting, however patiently, for a future reward. The pendulum swung when I met an Indian teacher named H.W.L. Punja, called Punjaji or Papaji by his students. Punjaji was a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, arguably the most widely revered Indian sage of the 20th century. Ramana's own awakening had been quite unusual because he had had no apparent spiritual interest or contact with a teacher. As a boy of 16, living in a middle-class family of South Indian Brahmins, he spontaneously became a spiritual adept. While sitting alone in his uncle's study, Ramana suddenly became paralyzed by a fear of death. He lay down on the floor, convinced that he would soon die, but rather than remaining terrified, he decided to locate the self that was about to disappear. He focused on the feeling of I, a process he later called self-inquiry, and found it to be absent from the field of consciousness. Ramana, the person, didn't die that day, but he claimed that the feeling of being a separate self never darkened his consciousness again. After fruitlessly attempting to behave like the ordinary boy he had once been, Ramana left home and traveled to Tiruvannamalai, an ancient pilgrimage site for followers of Shiva. He spent the rest of his life there, in proximity to the mountain Arunachala, with which he claimed to have a mystical connection. In the early years after his awakening, Ramana seemed to lose his ability to speak, and he was said to grow so absorbed in his experience of transfigured consciousness that he remained motionless for days at a time. His body grew weak, developed sores, and had to be tended by the few locals who had taken an interest in him. After a decade of silence, around 1906, Ramana began to conduct dialogues about the nature of consciousness. Until the end of his life, a steady stream of students came to study with him. These are the sorts of things he was apt to say. The mind is a bundle of thoughts. The thoughts arise because there is the thinker. The thinker is the ego. The ego, if sought, will automatically vanish. Reality is simply the loss of the ego. Destroy the ego by seeking its identity. Because ego is no entity, it will automatically vanish and reality will shine forth by itself. This is the direct method, whereas all other methods are done only retaining the ego. No sadhanas, spiritual practices, are necessary for engaging in this quest. There is no greater mystery than this, that being the reality, we seek to gain reality. We think that there is something hiding our reality and that it must be destroyed before the reality is gained. It is ridiculous. A day will dawn when you will yourself laugh at your past efforts. That which will be on the day you laugh is also here and now. Any attempt to make sense of such teachings in third-person scientific terms quickly produces monstrosities. From the point of view of psychological science, for instance, the mind is not just a bundle of thoughts. And in what sense can reality simply be, quote, the loss of the ego? Does this reality include quasars and hantavirus? But these are the kinds of quibbles that will cause one to miss Ramana's point. While the philosophy of Advaita and Ramana's own words may tend to support a metaphysical reading of teachings of this kind, their validity is not metaphysical. Rather, it is experiential. The whole of Advaita reduces to a series of very simple and testable assertions. Consciousness is the prior condition of every experience. The self or ego is an illusory appearance within it. Look closely for what you are calling I, and the feeling of being a separate self will disappear. What remains, as a matter of experience, is a field of consciousness, free, undivided, and intrinsically uncontaminated by its ever-changing contents. These are the simple truths that Punjaji taught. In fact, he was even more uncompromising than his guru in his non-duality. Whereas Ramana would often concede the utility of certain dualistic practices, Punjaji never gave an inch. The effect was intoxicating, especially to those of us who had spent years practicing meditation. Punjaji was also given to spontaneous bouts of weeping and laughter, both apparently from sheer joy. The man did not hide his light under a bushel. When I first met him, he had not yet been discovered by the throngs of Western devotees who would soon turn his tiny house in Lucknow into a spiritual circus. Like his teacher Ramana, Punjaji claimed to be perfectly free from the illusion of the self. And by all appearances, he was. And like Ramana and every other Indian guru, Punjaji would occasionally say something deeply unscientific. On the whole, however, his teaching was remarkably free of Hindu religiosity or unwarranted assertions about the nature of the cosmos. He appeared to simply speak from experience about the nature of experience itself. Punjaji's influence on me was profound, especially because it came as a corrective to all the strenuous and unsatisfying efforts I'd been making in meditation up to that point. But the dangers inherent in his approach soon became obvious. The all-or-nothing quality of Punjaji's teaching obliged him to acknowledge the full enlightenment of any person who was grandiose or manic enough to claim it. Thus, I repeatedly witnessed fellow students declare their complete and undying freedom, all the while appearing quite ordinary, or worse. In certain cases, these people had clearly had some sort of breakthrough, but Punjaji's insistence upon the finality of every legitimate insight led many of them to delude themselves about their spiritual attainments. Some left India and became gurus. From what I could tell, Punjaji gave everyone his blessing to spread his teachings in this way. He once suggested that I do it, and yet it was clear to me that I was not qualified to be anyone's guru. Nearly 20 years have passed, and I'm still not. Of course, from Punjaji's point of view, this is an illusion. And yet there simply is a difference between a person like myself, who is generally distracted by thought, and one who isn't and cannot be. I don't know where to place Punjaji on this continuum of wisdom, but he appeared to be a lot farther along than his students. Whether Punjaji was capable of seeing the difference between himself and other people, I do not know. But his insistence that no difference existed began to seem either dogmatic or delusional. On one occasion, events conspired to perfectly illuminate the flaw in Punjaji's teaching. A small group of experienced practitioners, among us several teachers of meditation, had organized a trip to India and Nepal to spend 10 days with Punjaji in Lucknow, followed by 10 days in Kathmandu, to receive teachings on the Tibetan Buddhist practice of Dzogchen. As it happened, during our time in Lucknow, a woman from Switzerland became, quote, enlightened in Punjaji's presence. For the better part of a week, she was celebrated as something akin to the next Buddha. Punjaji repeatedly put her forward as evidence of how fully the truth could be realized without making any effort at all in meditation. And we had the pleasure of seeing this woman sit beside Punjaji on a raised platform, expounding upon how blissful it now was in her corner of the universe. She was, in fact, radiantly happy, and it was by no means clear that Punjaji had made a mistake in recognizing her. She would say things like, "There is nothing but consciousness, and there is no difference between it and reality itself." Coming from such a nice, guileless person, there was little reason to doubt the profundity of her experience. When it came time for our group to leave India for Nepal, this woman asked if she could join us. Because she was such good company, we encouraged her to come along. A few of us were also curious to see how her realization would appear in another context. And so it came to pass that a woman whose enlightenment was just confirmed by one of the greatest living exponents of Advaita Vedanta was in the room when we received our first teachings from Tuku Urgyen Rinpoche, who was generally thought to be one of the greatest living Dzogchen masters. Of all the Buddhist teachings, those of Dzogchen most closely resemble the teachings of Advaita. The two traditions seek to provoke the same insight into the non-duality of consciousness. But generally speaking, only Dzogchen makes it absolutely clear that one must practice this insight to the point of stability, and that one can only do so without succumbing to the dualistic striving that haunts most other paths. At a certain point in our discussions with Tuku Urgyen, our Swiss prodigy declared her boundless freedom in terms similar to those she had used to such great effect with Punjaji. After a few highly amusing exchanges, during which we watched Tuku Urgyen struggle to understand what our translator was telling him, he gave a short laugh and looked the woman over with renewed interest. "How long has it been since you were last lost in thought?" he asked. "I haven't had any thoughts for over a week," the woman replied. Tuku Urgyen smiled. "A week?" "Yes." "No thoughts?" "No, my mind is completely still. It's just pure consciousness." "That's very interesting. Okay, so this is what's going to happen now. We're all just going to sit here and wait for you to have your next thought. There's no hurry. We're all very patient people. We're just going to sit here and wait. Please tell us when you notice a thought arise in your mind." It is difficult to convey what a brilliant and subtle intervention this was. It may have been the most inspired moment of teaching I have ever witnessed. After a few moments, a look of doubt appeared on our friend's face. "Okay, wait a minute. Oh, that could have been a thought there. Okay." Over the next 30 seconds, we watched this woman's enlightenment completely unravel. It became clear that she'd been merely thinking about how expansive her experience of consciousness had become, how it was perfectly free of thought, immaculate, just like space, without noticing that she was thinking incessantly. She had been telling herself the story of her enlightenment, and she'd been getting away with it because she happened to be an extraordinarily happy person, for whom everything was going very well for the time being. This was the danger of non-dual teachings of the sort that Poonjiji was handing out to all comers. It was easy to delude oneself into thinking that one had achieved a permanent breakthrough, especially because he insisted that all breakthroughs must be permanent. What the Dzogchen teachings make clear, however, is that thinking about what is beyond thought is still thinking, and a glimpse of selflessness is generally only the beginning of a process that must reach fruition. Being able to stand perfectly free of the feeling of self is the start of one's spiritual journey, not its end. Dzogchen, Taking the Goal as the Path. Tuku Urgyen Rinpoche lived in a hermitage on the southern slope of Shivapuri Mountain, overlooking the Kathmandu Valley. He spent more than 20 years of his life on formal retreat, and was deservedly famous for the clarity with which he gave the, quote, pointing out instruction of Dzogchen, a formal initiation in which a teacher seeks to impart the experience of self-transcendence directly to a student. I received this teaching from several Dzogchen masters, as well as similar instructions from teachers like Poonjiji in other traditions. But I never met anyone who spoke about the nature of consciousness as precisely as Tuku Urgyen. In the last 5 years of his life, I made several trips to Nepal to study with him. The practice of Dzogchen requires that one be able to experience the intrinsic selflessness of awareness in every moment, that is, when one is not otherwise distracted by thought. Which is to say that for a Dzogchen meditator, mindfulness must be synonymous with dispelling the illusion of the self. Rather than teach a technique of meditation, such as paying close attention to one's breathing, a Dzogchen master must precipitate an insight on the basis of which a student can thereafter practice a form of awareness, the Tibetan term is Rigpa, that is unencumbered by subject-object dualism. Thus, it is often said in Dzogchen, one takes the goal as the path, because the freedom from self that one might otherwise seek is the very thing that one practices. The goal of Dzogchen, if one can call it such, is to grow increasingly familiar with this way of being in the world. In my experience, some Dzogchen masters are better teachers than others. I've been in the presence of several of the most revered Tibetan lamas of our time while they were ostensibly teaching Dzogchen, and most of them simply described this view of consciousness without giving clear instructions on how to glimpse it. The genius of Tuku Urgyen was that he could point out the nature of mind with the precision and matter-of-factness of teaching a person how to thread a needle, and could get an ordinary meditator like me to recognize that consciousness is intrinsically free of self. There might be some initial struggle and uncertainty, depending on the student, but once the truth of non-duality had been glimpsed, it became obvious that it was always available, and there was never any doubt about how to see it again. I came to Tuku Urgyen yearning for the experience of self-transcendence, and in a few minutes he showed me that I had no self to transcend. In my view, there is nothing supernatural or even mysterious about this transmission of wisdom from master to disciple. Tuku Urgyen's effect on me came purely from the clarity of his teaching. As it is with any challenging endeavor, the difference between being utterly misled by false information, being nudged in the general direction, and being precisely guided by an expert is difficult to overstate. The direct perception of the optic blind spot again provides a useful analogy. Imagine that perceiving the blind spot will completely transform a person's life. Next, imagine that whole religions, such as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are predicated on the denial of the blind spot's existence. Let us say that their central doctrines assert the perfect uniformity of the visual field. Perhaps other traditions acknowledge the blind spot, but in purely poetical terms, without giving any clear indication of how to recognize it. A few lineages may actually teach techniques whereby one can see the blind spot for oneself, but only gradually, after months and years of effort, and even then one's glimpse of it will seem more a matter of luck than anything else. In a more esoteric tradition still, a, quote, blind spot master gives the pointing out instruction, but without much precision. Perhaps he tells you to close one eye for reasons that are never made explicit, and then says that the spot you seek is right on the surface of your vision. No doubt some people will succeed in discovering the blind spot under these conditions, but the teacher could certainly be clearer than this. How much clearer? If Tuku Urgyen had been pointing out the blind spot, he would have produced a figure with a fixation cross and a dot, like the one we're all familiar with from school, and given the following instructions. Hold this figure in front of you at arm's length. Close your left eye and stare at the cross with your right. Gradually move the page closer to your face while keeping your gaze fixed on the cross. Notice when the dot on the right disappears. Once you find your blind spot, continue to experiment with this figure by moving the page back and forth until any possibility of doubt about the existence of the blind spot has disappeared. It is considered bad form in most spiritual circles, especially among Buddhists, to make claims about one's own realization. However, I think this taboo comes at a high price because it allows people to remain confused about how to practice. So I will describe my experience plainly. Before meeting Thukku Urgyen, I had spent at least a year practicing Vipassana on silent retreats. The experience of self-transcendence was not entirely unknown to me. I could remember moments when the distance between the observer and the observed had seemed to vanish, but I viewed these experiences as being dependent on conditions of extreme mental concentration. Consequently, I thought they were unavailable in more ordinary moments outside intensive retreat. But after a few minutes, Thukku Urgyen simply handed me the ability to cut through the illusion of the self directly, even in ordinary states of consciousness. This instruction was, without question, the most important thing I have ever been explicitly taught by another human being. It has given me a way to escape the usual tides of psychological suffering, fear, anger, shame, in an instant. At my level of practice, this freedom lasts only a few moments. But these moments can be repeated, and they can grow in duration. Punctuating ordinary experience in this way makes all the difference. In fact, when I pay attention, it is impossible for me to feel like a self at all. The implied center of cognition and emotion simply falls away. And it is obvious that consciousness is never truly confined by what it knows. That which is aware of sadness is not sad. That which is aware of fear is not fearful. The moment I am lost in thought, however, I'm as confused as anyone else. Given this change in my perception of the world, I understand the attractions of traditional spirituality. I also recognize the needless confusion and harm that inevitably arises from the doctrines of faith-based religion. I did not have to believe anything irrational about the universe or about my place within it to learn the practice of Dzogchen. I didn't have to accept Tibetan Buddhist beliefs about karma and rebirth, or imagine that Thukku Urgyen or the other meditation masters I met possessed magic powers. Whatever the traditional liabilities of the guru-devotee relationship, I know from direct experience that it is possible to meet a teacher who can deliver the goods. Unfortunately, to begin the practice of Dzogchen, it is generally necessary to meet a qualified teacher. There's a large literature on the topic, of course, and much of what I've written throughout this book represents my own effort to point out the nature of awareness. But to have their confusion and doubts resolved, most people need to be in dialogue with a teacher who can answer questions in real time. Thukku Urgyen is no longer alive, but I'm told that his sons Sokni Rinpoche and Mingyur Rinpoche generally teach in his style. And many other Tibetan lamas teach Dzogchen as well. However, one can never be sure how much Buddhist religiosity one will be asked to imbibe along the way. My advice is that if you seek out these teachings, don't be satisfied until you are certain that you understand the practice. Dzogchen is not vague or paradoxical. It is not like Zen, wherein a person can spend years being uncertain whether he's meditating correctly. The practice of recognizing non-dual awareness is called trekchot, which means cutting through in Tibetan, as in cutting a string cleanly so that both ends fall away. Once one has cut it, there is no doubt that it has been cut. I recommend that you demand the same clarity of your meditation practice. Beyond duality. Think of something pleasant in your personal life. Visualize the moment when you accomplished something that you were proud of, or had a good laugh with a friend. Take a minute to do this. Notice how the mere thought of the past evokes a feeling